It's 8:10 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Summit County Council recently agreed to move forward with its goal to be 100% renewable. In the studio with details about how we do that, I have the county's sustainability coordinator, Lisa Yoder. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So start by going over the basic goals for us. When does the county government want to be 100% renewable? Because that's different, I think, than doing it countywide.
Right. Well, first of all, the resolution will be heard and reviewed this coming October 4th. So it has not yet been approved. Hopefully this coming Wednesday. So the goal, there's a little bit of nuance in the goal to be worked out, but it looks like the county operations would be 100% renewable by 2022 would be the goal for the county operations, and then 2032 for the community.
Okay, so similar to what Park City has done.
Similar, yes.
Yeah. And then, of course, how do we get buy-in here? Of course, we've got folks here on the west side saying, you know, we're all in. I mean, is that true for the east side as well?
Now, are we talking about the 100% renewable?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the goal would be to work with utilities and large-scale developers to provide the opportunity for all residents to purchase 100% renewable. As you know, we need 100% renewable electrical energy to achieve any significant emissions reduction. And by providing some mechanism for residents to opt in or opt out, individuals can choose. This is not something that we can force on all county residents, but we would expect all of those who want to buy in or opt out of a system would have that opportunity.
Okay, so talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, I know that there are some ongoing talks with Rocky Mountain Power. To do what exactly?
Because we haven't adopted this goal, we have not yet entered into cooperative agreement with Rocky Mountain Power. Adopting this resolution would be the first step. The second step would then be to engage with Rocky Mountain Power in similar way that Park City and Salt Lake City and I believe Moab have already. And then we would begin those conversations to see what Summit County residents need for capacity generation and begin that process.
So how is it that we could get 100% electric energy that isn't derived from coal or natural gas? I mean, how's that done?
Well, it's a net measure. So you would acquire solar, renewable, maybe hydro from other sources through the grid, through power purchase agreements, or through possibly developing large-scale solar on-site in the county or off-site and wheeling the power here. There are some regulatory barriers that need to be considered. This is a big project, you know, a long-scale kind of effort.
Yeah, but isn't that the criticism about solar panels? And that is that we're just putting all of the emissions someplace else since our power plants are still coal generated?
Well, we're not going to shut down the coal plants. That's not going to happen. They will eventually be turned over to natural gas. I don't know. The future may require some level of coal, but I think it's important to have a mix provided from all the places you can and use the technology that's available now and in the near future to get there. So, like, as you know, the sun only shines during the day, so the net measure would be you generate more power during the day than you use throughout the day, but you're going to need another source for power during the nighttime. So until batteries are developed and further technology is developed, we will rely on other sources like coal, fossil fuels, natural gas, hydro, whatever is out there.
So talk a little bit about what 100% net renewable is. I mean, I think that the case can be made that we can play number games sometimes when measuring the net impact, you know, the net impacts of something.
So let's say on a given day your building uses, I don't know, 1,500 kilowatts of electricity and 8 decatherms of natural gas. 100% net renewable energy, or for us, it's net electrical energy. So we're not talking about the heating or gas, natural gas or heating. We're talking about electrical energy. So you generate 1,500 kilowatts of electricity during the day, and you use 1,500 kilowatts throughout the day. That's the net. That's a measure to make to achieve 100% net measured renewable energy.
All right. So in terms of the county making its operations net zero, what's the plan for that?
The plan would be to continue to install solar on the appropriate buildings. We've done a study in the last 2 years that analyzed all our buildings and the capacity that we have for rooftop solar. Before we put the solar on, we make the buildings more efficient through LED retrofits and recommissioning existing systems. So you lower the demand, then the solar panels achieve more of your generation that's needed. We also will be working with staff and operations of the building to lower the demand through energy behavior, occupant behavior. So those would be you have to lower the demand, install the solar, and that's how we would get to 100% net of county operations.
Again, and we're talking just electric, because we haven't figured out how it is that we become net net zero
right.
Especially when we got big snowplows pushing things around. And
well, right, and when you look at your home, most of the homes are heated with natural gas, which is more efficient at heating than electricity. So until we're ready to address switching all of our homes to electrical systems to heat them, you know, that's a little bit further down the road than the electricity goal, which is achievable.
So why is this a worthy goal in spending money on?
Well, the question I often ask is, what if you don't do it? What's the alternative? The emissions we know from coal-fired power plants, we have the technology to go to solar and renewables. Why not? If we don't do it, we continue to emit emissions that are harmful to health and the environment and the natural world. We can't afford not to.
And again, is that, do you think, the same mindset that we see countywide? I mean, is, you know, here in the Park City area, of course, we think of, you know, snow as the number one economic engine driver. But is that kind of does snow float all the boats here in Summit County?
Well, I don't think so. It doesn't necessarily float my boat, for example. But climate change has impacts on drought, on agriculture, on wildlife, on every aspect of our life. So whether you want to look at it from a climate change affecting snow climate change that affects our life, everyone's life, certainly not everybody believes in it. Not everybody feels that the county should invest in these things, but I would argue we can't afford not to invest in it for the future of all of us.
So what's the 2018 budget request then from the Sustainability Office to make all of this happen?
Well, that's complicated. The Sustainability Office operates its own budget, but the requests that I make are from the capital budget to make these improvements to buildings, to install solar, to upgrade vehicles to more efficient vehicles that use less fuel. So while the requests increase, they also, the part that's not really seen is that they decrease other department budgets. So the fleet operating budget should go down with more efficient vehicles. The facilities budget should go down because of lower utility costs, but the capital budget and the sustainability budget may go up. So it's kind of unfair to look at just the sustainability budget as it goes up and down without considering its impact to other aspects of the budget.
So, of course, we hear the county manager supporting a tax increase so that we can continue to pay for our level of services. I think some would say, well, you know, why are we doing this when we're talking about having to increase taxes?
Why are we doing what?
You know, going forward with a goal that's just going to cost money.
Well, again, we pay the money whether we're efficient or not. We pay to turn the lights on. Now, do you want to pay for 60-watt bulbs or 9-watt bulbs? We pay to drive vehicles. Do we want to pay for efficient vehicles or less efficient vehicles? We pay for electricity. if we put solar on, we fix the base cost of electricity that generated by our own source on our rooftop. We fix that and protect it from a 2% increase each year that the utility imposes. So there are, it's the long-term costs that are reduced by short-term investments. And that's why, in my mind, it's important to make these investments.
All right. So I guess that's not the message I think that's getting out, is that we're doing this.
I keep working at it. I keep working at it. It's a hard sell somehow.
Okay. So again, it comes before the county council on October 4th.
Correct.
And at that point, then, I mean, if you get the go ahead, then what's the next goal?
Then at that point, then I work diligently with department heads. As you can see, the council understands and staff understands this affects all departments. This is a concerted effort by all parts of government that we work together with the community and interdepartmentally to achieve these goals. And we met already, some of the directors and I yesterday, and we will be developing a very concise strategic plan that makes clear the definitions, the boundaries, what we can measure and impact and what we can't. And we lay that all out and figure out, then we get into the details of more specifically how we're going to achieve this.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to add, Lisa?
No, I think I covered it.
Okay. Hey, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
Coming up now on 8:30. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher with the Park City Planning Commission meeting and work session tomorrow starting at 5:30 in the City Council Chambers in the studio with a preview of the agenda. Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Leslie.
So during work session, we're talking about 638 Park Avenue, the building formerly known as the Kimball Art Center. Do we have a new name for it?
Not as far as I know. We are calling it the Kimball Garage at this point. There's no really new name. This is the Kimball Project going forward, and it has to do with the event space on the second floor.
So the work session to discuss the Park City Council remand of the conditional use permit for a private event facility. So what direction did the council give to the Planning Commission when they sent it back to them?
The City Council asked the Planning Commission to look carefully at the conditions of approval that the Planning Commission approved and that the public appealed. They want to make sure that the issues of noise are addressed correctly. They want to make sure the issues of traffic and drop-off are addressed as well.
The Planning Commission, though, originally gave a positive recommendation to this. So now they're being asked to second-guess what they first thought?
They're being asked to look harder at it and make sure that the conditions are appropriate for that site. Remember that this particular location is not the same as our other outdoor event spaces and outdoor decks on Main Street. This is a little bit closer to our residential district. And this is a larger space than most of the outdoor decks that we have.
And we do have that open rooftop where I'm guessing a lot of the partying will happen, especially during the summer months when everybody in Old Town has their windows open. And I guess the similarity I would bring up would be the no-name rooftop. But again, you're saying it's smaller due to size. I mean, it backs right up against...
Oh, I agree. And if you'll remember back in the day when we were trying to get that approved through when it was the Alamo, there's a restriction on the occupancy of that outdoor deck. And one of the reasons that a portion of that outdoor deck on the no name is closed off is to manage the occupancy to the level that was originally approved. So in the case of the Kimball, they're trying to figure out how they can manage the noise and continue to operate that deck at the size that it is.
So do we get a lot of complaints from the no-name about noise?
On occasion, I think the more noise issues that we face are from some of our larger indoor venues where the residents from the bass and music residents through the neighborhood. And if we've got a historic building, it's almost impossible to control the mechanical vibration from musical noise. So very difficult situation.
So as we know, when this was before the Planning Commission, lots of public input against it, noise being, I think, the number one issue. The applicant says that they'll be using sound-limiting equipment. So what kind of equipment are we talking about?
In the current political environment, I would tell you that this is super secret technology from Europe. But basically what it is it's sound measuring devices that are on the perimeter of the deck, and what they would do is if they exceed the noise ordinance for a period of time, say a minute or two, then they'll shut down the music.
So is it the music that's the concern, or is it just
that's
people
what
talking?
They're regular? Well, it's noise, but there's no way for the sound measuring devices to tell people to stop talking. So it's mainly the music.
All right. So again, neighborhood compatibility, I think, another issue. I mean, is this an appropriate use for a building? It's in a commercial district, but certainly, again, one that backs up to people's bedrooms.
Well, it's right on the edge of things. It's at the bottom of Main Street. There's going to be some complications here, and I think the Planning Commission is going to have a very difficult decision one way or another, and ultimately it may end up back at the City Council.
And again, with the, I mean, they're well under construction, and they're building a special event facility. How fair is that now to second-guess them? Or?
Well, I don't know that we're second-guessing them. The appeal has been going on for several months now. They could also just make an application for outdoor dining, which would be a different application, and they're certainly in the constraints of the zone to do an outdoor dining deck as well on that location. So it's kind of complicated, and you know, we're in the business of protecting the neighborhoods, but I think that we have to manage the zone as well.
So there was also some talk about perhaps a rooftop tent. Would that make a difference?
The applicant has withdrawn the tent at this point. So they would go in for a special event permit if they wanted to do a tent, say, during Sundance or during the Arts Festival. That'd be a separate application. So that's been withdrawn from the conditional use permit.
And then, as you mentioned, also traffic, drop-off, parking issues. City Engineer Matt Castle doesn't think that the event space would bring more traffic. How does he come to that conclusion?
Well, you'd probably have to chat with Matt about that, but basically there have been events in that space. The parking for that space is in the China Bridge structure. I think there is some concern about load in, load out. The public certainly had some concerns about special events, including perhaps weddings and activities like that where people want to be dropped off at the front door. We'll see. My basic mission on this one is I can do nothing to disrupt transit or disrupt snow removal on those two intersections. So the planning department is being very, very careful with what they do with Heber and Park and Heber and Main.
All right. What we don't have there, though, is kind of a bowl bin or a cut-in.
Yeah, and I have to tell you that the planning department is not in favor of the bowl bin right now. Like I say, we can do nothing to disrupt snow removal, and the bulbs tend to slow snow removal down and affect how storm drainage works. So unless it's done absolutely perfectly, we just make a bad situation worse. You know, we have the same sort of bulb in condition at Sky Lodge. Back in the day, we approved valet parking instead of public parking spaces off of Heber Avenue. Not real sure planning is comfortable with that situation, and I don't know that we would do that again.
Okay, except that you love the parking right in front.
I want the colon number, so I'm fine with that.
So when we talk about kind of tweaking the conditions of approval, we're talking about tightening them up? Is that what the
Yes, the applicant has submitted a document that they're dealing with additional noise mitigation strategies, and they've come up with a process by which the public is aware of the events. They've come up with a process by which the event manager has to manage noise. There's some documents they have to fill out, and that gives us a reporting mechanism. So the Planning Commission is going to have to decide whether this is a tool that we can use as we go forward.
All right. Anything else you think we ought to mention with that issue?
No, at this point, I think we need the Planning Commission to take a look at it and weigh in on it.
All right. Later on in the regular session, commissioners will consider an ordinance amending the Land Management Code Chapter 2. This is regarding roof pitches, limiting the use of flat roofs to protect streetscape facades. So talk to me about how a flat roof takes away from the streetscape in your mind.
Okay. Well,
it gives us lots of view.
Well, you know? And I think that that's part of the discussion. But as far as the Planning Department is concerned and the Historic Preservation Board, which has already approved this thing unanimously, the primary concern is preservation of our historic district and the thematic National Register listing for the district. And so flat roofs tend to disrupt the rhythm and scale of the roofscape when viewed from the street. So if you're seeing five houses with pitched roofs and then you see a flat roof, that volume is taken away and it's kind of like a missing tooth out of the streetscape. And so in order to protect our district, we're not encouraging contemporary design that steps away from our architectural character. And that's what our land management code and general plan call for. This is just a mechanism by which we can be more precise in allowing these things. We're also doing our best to kind of deregulate a little bit, just a little bit, the opportunity to do green roofs, which would be roofs that contain stormwater and allow plants to grow on them, sort of like what we see on the top of China Bridge.
So is this just deal with residential construction?
Yeah, it's just in the residential districts. It's not on Main Street because obviously all the buildings on Main Street have flat roofs.
That's my point. I mean, you look out here and it's like every building we can see is flat.
Yeah, we're kind of at the bottom here on Sweet Alley, but I think as you go through our neighborhoods, you'll see a preponderance of pitch roofs, which is the traditional form for the miners' houses and the historic forms that moved forward through the 60s. So the message is if you want to do contemporary architecture, and honestly, Leslie, it's not really contemporary. Our friends in Palm Springs actually have a historic district for flat roof houses from the 1950s. And so introduction of this particular architectural style is not contemplated in the land management code, and it's not contemplated in the general plan. And the historic district preservation planners are working very hard to just clarify the ordinance to make sure that we continue with our thematic districts.
So does this have anything to do with the house plan for the downhill side of Woodside Avenue in which an appeal was filed?
It does not. This has been going on now almost 5 years as part of the historic district design review that the HPB, the Historic Preservation Board, has been doing. So we've been at this 5 years. The planning and the preservation folks would tell you that we've been in front of the Historic Preservation Board probably a half a dozen times. We've been in front of the City Council three or four times on the issue of maintaining historic character.
Okay. Anything else going on in the planning department?
No, things are pretty quiet. Mostly we nap and, kind of go to lunch. We've got the Treasure Project coming forward again. That's moving forward. Planner Astorga is putting together some additional staff reports. So that will be back in October. It looks like we're going to have two meetings on that in October as we work through the final discussions with the Planning Commission.
So staff has agreed then to do a couple of meetings in October?
Yes, we've agreed. We have agreed to do a couple of meetings in October. We've agreed to consider additional meetings in November in order to bring this to a resolution one way or another.
Okay, Bruce, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
Parks coming up on Thursday, the Park City Film Series in partnership with the Women's Giving Fund presents the free screening of She Started It. In the studio, I have Film Series Director Katie Wang, along with one of those who will be on the post-film panel, Juliana Duran. She's the Associate Director of Panda Labs and the Park City Angel Staff Analyst and Facilitator. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Morning.
So, Katie, let's have you start and just kind of give us a preview of the film, what it's about, and maybe who would be interested in seeing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is part of our Real Community Series, where we partner with other nonprofits to help elevate their mission through film. And as you said, our partner this month is the Women's Giving Fund, which is a project of the Park City Community Foundation. And they have a mentoring program for girls in grades 6 and 7. To get them interested in STEM careers and really provide role models for them. And we thought that this was a great platform to talk about entrepreneurship and young female entrepreneurs, which is kind of a rare breed in the entrepreneurship sector. So the film She Started It is about five different young female tech entrepreneurs. And it talks about the challenges of bringing your ideas to market that any entrepreneur certainly faces, but also the extra challenge these young women face because there's a lack of female role models in the entrepreneurship sector and investors that are willing to support their ideas. So we thought it'd be a great way to kind of talk about it at a meta level in terms of what's happening in Silicon Valley and around the country and the globe, but then bring it down to the local level with the post-film panel. And so we'll have some local entrepreneurs, Juliana, as you mentioned, Heather Zinzak, who's the CMO of Pluralsight, and Tally Kotler, who is in the Park City High School, and she actually started the Lady Bots, which is their female robotics team. So I think it's certainly an inspirational film and a conversation for the young women in our community, but I think also for young men to really see, you know, kind of that adage, you can see it, you can be it, to really see that there are these female leaders in our community, certainly, and around the world that are, you know, inspirational in the challenges that they face, that an entrepreneur brings to market. And it's not, it doesn't look just one way. It's certainly right now it's pretty white and male, but it doesn't have to be that way. And certainly these women are proving that.
So Julianne, apparently you have a background in entrepreneurship. What's that?
Yes. So I went to the University of Utah. My major was entrepreneurship. While even before I got into this career path, my dad started a transportation company here in Park City, and he asked me as an 18-year-old to interview for his chauffeurs. So that was my first experience. I thought it was amazing to have the opportunity to, you know, interview folks and sort of get on top of the ladder, sort of what I call hacking the system and, you know, being a leader. So then I got into University of Utah, started my own business, ran a sign company for 2 years, and got involved in a couple different programs there at the university.
So I'm guessing with your dad, you may have had the financial backing you needed for your sign company, or not the case. So he made you go out and find the money yourself.
That is not the case at all. So my sign company was bootstrapped from the very beginning. There were many situations where I had to upfront the money for the materials for a big job and be, you know, eating pizza for the rest of the week as a result. But it was a really good experience, and it really taught me the value of work, and it taught me that as an entrepreneur, you can get more value out of your work than you can in the workplace, because if you work harder, you'll see the results.
Yeah. But did you feel, I mean, is it different, do you think, for a woman to pitch ideas as opposed to a man pitching ideas?
Absolutely. It's really rooted into the system. This problem is rooted into the system. So it's proven that investors relate to entrepreneurs not only in a professional way, but they also see themselves in the entrepreneurs. So if we have less female investors in the room, that means less people are going to be able to relate to that female entrepreneur, that young entrepreneur in the room.
So as someone who helps with funding good ideas through the Park City Angels and Pando Labs, I mean, what's your advice then to female entrepreneurs?
Great question. My advice would be to be confident, to not look at yourself as a female entrepreneur. I certainly didn't see myself as a female business owner or as a, you know, a female professional. I think if it's easier if we hold ourselves to the standards of society and consider ourselves successful leaders rather than female leaders.
So, Katie, there's going to be an entrepreneur showcase after the panel. Tell me about that.
Yep. So after the panel, as we were putting together the panel, we realized, wow, there are so many women in our community that run their own businesses and started their own businesses. How can we celebrate all of them? And again, the idea is that to provide role models for the young women and young men in our community, and not everyone's going to go into the tech, you know, industry, right? I mean, that's great. You can design your own app and all these other things. But some people want to, I don't know, pet grooming business, or we have Auntie M who's a baker. So there's so many, you know, the diversity of entrepreneurship is vast. So we really wanted to represent that in the showcase. So we've invited women from every sector we could think of that are in the community to come together and really celebrate them, and also have an opportunity for the young women and men that come to the screening to connect with these different people and see who they are. I mean, these are people you'll see in the grocery store. You might see them, you know, at a concert, and that you can connect with them and have coffee and share ideas. And, you know, so much of business is about mentorship. And so really to provide that mentorship opportunity for them through the showcase. So it's a free screening. Screening starts at 6:30. The film's only 60 minutes long. So kind of a tight little nugget of a film. film there, and then the panel, of course, that you'll be moderating for about 20, 30 minutes, and then the showcase afterwards. So we'd love for people to come to all of it, but if you can only come to part, you know, that's kind of the timing of the evening.
Okay. How many folks do you have as part of the showcase?
We have about 25 right now. Wow. But we're inviting, you know, any woman that's listening, that's an entrepreneur that would like to show up. If you haven't RSVP'd yet, if we haven't had an opportunity to reach out to you, please, you know, identify yourself when you get there. And, we, you know, more is more. So we'd love to have you there.
I know they're out there. I'm inspired by them every day in this community.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're really looking forward to it. So parkcityfilmseries.org if you want to check out the trailer and some of the details if you've missed any of it. So
okay. Katie Wang and Juliana Duran, thanks.
Thank you.
It's 8:50 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Summit County Jail has more than 20 programs going on right now that include recovery, life skills, and education. In the studio with a look at those programs and how they help our inmates, I have Summit County Sheriff Justin Martinez. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's talk about, I mean, what are these programs that are offered? And it's the county sheriff's office that offers these?
Correct. So they're offered to the inmates. And we've got a wide range of programs that we provide to the inmates, from vocational skills, construction, culinary, where they get the food handler's permit, janitorial, gardening, substance abuse and recovery, life skills such as parenting, anger management, behavior modification, accountability and responsibility recognition, arts, and, you know, just your general religious services. So we have a wide array of programs available to our inmates.
So are they, like, ongoing, or are they kind of just one-time workshops? Or
a little bit of both. So our average stay at the jail is about 10 to 12 days. That's the average. Now, we do have some inmates that are there that are incarcerated for up to 2 years. So they're ongoing, but if someone's in for a short time, they can still take advantage of one or two classes and drop in and drop out. But, you know, even those, I think, are beneficial as well.
Yeah. And some of them, are they required then as part of their parole? Or
some of them, such as the substance abuse. If a judge orders them into substance rehabilitation, then those are court ordered. Others, I think we provide it, and they don't always take us up on that. But, for example, like a simple thing is a food handler's permit. We provide them the opportunity to get their food handler's permit in hopes that when they get out, we're just going to reduce recidivism and they can go get a job. So, yeah, there are some that are court ordered and there's some that they volunteer to attend.
Yeah. So who teaches the courses or the programs?
We have 7 of our 20 courses are actually paid facilitators. So they're paid either through state contracts, county contracts, or through state education. The other courses are volunteers. We have over 100 volunteers that come in and teach these courses.
Hmm. So which ones are the most well-liked or the most used?
You know, it's really interesting because there's some that are I don't want to say gender specific, but for example, we have a knitting program. And a lot of the women will come in and they'll knit. And they've knit blankets, hats for babies. And we've actually taken those what they've knitted, and we've given over to the women's clinic for their children. So there's a lot that goes right back into the community. For the guys, I think there's a lot of construction. I think they all take advantage of our accountability and responsibility. You know, they know they're incarcerated for a reason, and we want to address that and identify that, have them self-identify what they've done wrong, and how they can prevent from doing that again.
Yeah. I know a couple of the popular ones I had heard were being on the road crew, even in picking up trash and gardening. And I guess it's just because they get to get outside?
Correct. And those ones are a little bit different. So those ones are for state inmates. State inmates are the only ones that are allowed to go outside the facility. So they are inmates that we are housing for the state of Utah. They're low risk. They have to obviously go through a vetting process. And they're low-risk inmates that they can go out and be part of the road crew. In addition to that, going out in the gardening. And for them, it is a chance for them to get out, and they actually get paid. It doesn't sound like a lot, but for them, it's $8 a day that they go out, but they get to be outside, they get to learn skills, and they get to give back to the community, and then they make a little money that they can put on their commissary to get sodas and candy bars and so on and so forth.
Now, are some of the programs offered only due to good behavior, or is everything open to everyone?
everything's open. Let me restate that. Most programs are open to everyone because they're within the confines of the facility. Certain programs, such as the working inmate, the gardening, other things, it's required that you have good behavior, that you are basically a model inmate. And those are and then again, the state requirements for being on the road crew. So there's certain qualifications for certain programs, but by and large, your behaviorals, those are open to anybody.
So a lot of them sound like kind of hobbies. What about some educational programs in terms of getting their GED or, I don't know, expanding their education?
So, and that's really difficult because that's, again, one of those, when I talked about, they're in, the average time is 10 to 12 days. To get a GED takes a lot longer than that. So to have those programs that people might not take advantage of them on a long-term basis, it's hard to have those programs be sustainable. So we try to offer as much education as we can, but to actually provide them, and you hear about it in the news and stuff, but those programs are primarily in the prison systems because they're there for an extended amount of time. They can get an education. They can get their GED, where our turnover is so rapid that we just unfortunately don't have the time to invest because they're not going to be there long enough.
Okay. So I understand that you could use more volunteers. What are you looking for?
You know, we're looking for anybody that has a specific skill, anybody that's good at writing resumes, that has a skill in social work, has skills in conflict resolution, anybody that feels like they have a specific skill set that probably meet our inmate population, we'd love to hear from them. We'd love to hear from anybody that they feel that they can come out and even bring a new idea. I spoke with people at Nuzzles & Co. about wanting to introduce canines into the correctional facility to help raise abandoned animals. We addressed it, but there were some health concerns. There were some things, obviously, being in a jail system, the quick turnover, you know, there's a bonding that goes on with the animals and the inmates, and we just won't reach that level of bonding with that. So anybody that has an idea, we're more than happy to entertain it and introduce new ideas, new programs.
Yeah, some people may be thinking, I mean, why should we invest in them? They broke the law. We're already paying for the room and board with tax dollars. So why do you think these programs are important and that we maintain them?
You know, I think the primary issue for me as the sheriff is to reduce recidivism. Period. I don't want them coming back into the facility. And if we have an opportunity to provide them some counseling, some mental health, something as simple as a food handler's permit, and by and large, most of these programs, like I said, are volunteers. The food handler's permit, there's not a single tax dollar that goes for them to get the food handler's permit. They have to pay for it. We provide the training, but the training is provided by volunteers. But anything we can do to make them better in society, because I think for far too long we have basically locked them up and thrown away the key. They commit a crime, and obviously those that commit those egregious crimes, we need to lock them up. But those that have made a mistake, those that are incarcerated but need a break, and we have the opportunity to provide them that food handler's permit, a little bit of counseling, and that they can turn their life around and never come back, that actually saves taxpayer money. Because they'll never be back in the correctional facility. So hopefully what we can do is maybe have an impact and not just lock them up, let them do their time, but give them a resource.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No. If anybody's interested that wants to volunteer, they can reach us on our Twitter account at Summit County SO or Facebook, Summit County Sheriff at Utah.
Okay.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you. Summit County Sheriff Justin White.